You want to talk about canceled voices for Indigenous Americans? Biden administration won't listen to them.
Senator Sullivan rips the Biden administration on a pair of decisions protecting land in the Arctic from resource extraction. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 19th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, fisheries managers consider the impacts of the Bering Sea pollock fleet's chum salmon bycatch.
It's been framed as this trade-off of sorts between pollock fishing and subsistence, but it feels almost like a false choice.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. The Biden administration announced this morning two Alaska decisions that aim to protect the Arctic environment and hinder mining and drilling. One decision blocks a proposed 200-mile road to copper and zinc prospects near Ambler. The other fortifies conservation measures on half of the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, west of Prudhoe Bay. North Slope leaders and industry groups, among others, describe the moves as a federal land lockup intended to satisfy outside environmentalists. But some Arctic residents are thankful. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
Evansville Tribal Chief Frank Thompson has been fighting the Ambler Road proposal for years. He was in awe that the Bureau of Land Management and the Interior Department listened.
Today is a great day. Our future looks bright without the threat of 168 trucks driving by per day.
The road would run west of the Dalton Highway through a southern finger of the gates of the Arctic National Park. Tribal and non-tribal residents alike say they fear the road and commercial mining would irrevocably damage their traditional hunting and fishing. John Gadecki's family has been in the area for 50 years. He says advocating against a project like this is particularly hard for people who live off the land.
The traveling, the leaving fish nets and homes and huskies and wood piles behind. I mean, it's such a physical effort just to live in Alaska. And anytime we have to take away from that for meetings, it's just fantastic to be heard and know that our voices got all the way to Washington.
Of course, people in the region aren't all of the same mind. Some want the jobs and revenue from resource development. And it's the same with the rule to strengthen environmental protections in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan took to the Senate floor and put up a poster-sized photo of North Slope leaders who advocate for development in the NPRA.
You want to talk about canceled voices for Indigenous Americans? Biden administration won't listen to them.
The rule for the National Petroleum Reserve won't stop ConocoPhillips from developing the massive Willow Project. Half of the reserve was already off limits to development. The rule strengthens existing protections and puts them in regulation. Congresswoman Mary Peltola, a Democrat, joined both of Alaska's U.S. senators in slamming the Biden administration's decisions. She said in a press release that the petroleum reserve rule doesn't strike the right balance between development and conservation. And Peltola says blocking the Ambler Road was premature because area stakeholders are still discussing it. The senators describe the decisions as illegal. Ambler Road opponents say they're bracing for lawsuits. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska has one of the highest rates of binge drinking deaths in the United States, and those rates increased during and after COVID-19. But there are more options than ever for treating alcohol use disorder in the state, including several medications that can make it easier for some people to reduce or quit drinking. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra has more.
Katie Schneider has been the clinical director at South Central Foundation Detox for 20 years. She says about half the people in the 14-bed detox facility are working on alcohol dependence. And in those decades, the options for helping them with medication-assisted treatment have expanded.
It's actually really improved a lot. When I first started practicing, the only thing that we had was something called antabuse, which caused people to vomit every time they had alcohol. That is also still an option. It's just not one that we use a lot.
Antabuse has been around for about 75 years, but it didn't help people with cravings and caused severe reactions to food or drink with even tiny amounts of alcohol. Now, there are several options of medications that address alcohol dependency, which offer a gentler path to recovery. Schneider says she now encourages anyone in the detox facility to be open to medication.
We encourage everyone to do medication-assisted treatment because we feel that you should put every tool in your toolbox that you can.
Because drinking is often a coping mechanism, there's no one path to reducing or stopping. Schneider says medications may also include treatments for underlying disorders. She says drinking can mask mental health struggles. Part of recovery is figuring out the root causes of alcohol abuse, not just addressing the drinking itself.
Nobody wakes up one day and says, I just want to ruin my life with drugs and alcohol. There's always underlying causes, and there's childhood traumas, there's mental health disorders, there are maladaptive behaviors, all kinds of reasons.
That's also something Dr. Seth Workentine thinks about in his work. He's an addiction medicine fellow at Providence, Alaska in Anchorage. He says he always asks his patients for more information about when and why they're drinking. And he says sometimes those patterns reveal depression or anxiety. He says there are several longer-term medications to help with alcohol cravings. He says he has a few patients who prefer antabuse, but it's not very popular anymore. He says acamprosate is a newer medication which helps reduce cravings for alcohol.
And so patients feel that they're able to reduce their use or even go off completely and find that they're thinking about alcohol a lot less.
He says another medication is naltrexone, which can be used for reducing or quitting alcohol or opioids. He says some patients describe naltrexone as taking the fun out of drinking. Workentine says he encourages people using medication-assisted treatment to stay on the medications as long as they're willing, 6 months, a year, or even sometimes indefinitely. He says these medications improve success rates for recovery, and he says he's seen a shift toward more harm reduction approaches to addiction. Not everyone, he says, is ready to quit drinking completely.
There's this general shift in medicine to do more patient-centered care. We're a patient's coach. We're there to help them achieve the goals that they set out. There's no longer this what we call paternalistic medicine, where we describe what goals the patient should have.
Schneider says she's also seen this shift in addiction medicine. She says earlier in her career, doctors required patients to stop drinking completely when prescribing medications for alcohol use, and that's changed.
If someone goes from drinking a fifth a day to having two drinks a day, that is a win, and we should celebrate that.
She says she hopes that anyone who wants to change their drinking reaches out to a healthcare provider. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Spencer Woods of Shungnak wrestles for a spot on the U.S. Olympic team.
In the lower 48, you know, there's a common saying it takes a village, but in Alaska, it feels a little bit more literal.
That's ahead. Stay with us. Anchorage police say a cold case murder from nearly 15 years ago has been solved after a man who knew secret details of the crime came forward to confess last week. 56-year-old John Patrick Dahlquist has been charged with murder and attempted murder in the 2009 shootings of Sang Chun and Monty Howell at the Inlet Inn. The downtown inn was later demolished after numerous reports of crime in the area. According to a charging document, Howell told police at the time he was working at the inn's front desk when a man robbed the register of about $500 at gunpoint. The man ordered him and Chun to lie down, then shot each of them from behind, killing Chun. Police had a sketch made of the suspect, but say that after numerous interviews, the trail went cold. Last week, police say Dahlquist had workers at a bingo hall call them because he wanted to confess. In a series of interviews, he allegedly told investigators he had shot the men. He also said he used a model of pistol matching bullets recovered from the victims, a weapon police never publicly named. According to police, Dahlquist said people he knew had been urging him to come forward. Investigators say a DMV photo of Dahlquist taken at the time closely matched the suspect's sketch. Dahlquist was being held today at the Anchorage Correctional Complex. Chum salmon returns in western Alaska have reached emergency levels. Meanwhile, the federally managed pollock fishery in the Bering Sea is pulling up to 500,000 chum as bycatch. Pressure is mounting for fisheries managers to limit the amount of salmon bycatch in the pollock fishery. KUCB's Theo Greenlee reports that the issue took center stage at April's meeting of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council in Anchorage.
I can't imagine life without salmon hanging in my smokehouse and in my freezer.
The testimonies are harrowing.
We used to live in fish camp.
A mother who fears she won't be able to teach her children to cut, hang, and smoke fish. Subsistence practitioners who rely on frozen fish donations because they can't fish for chum on their own rivers.
We are in a salmon crisis where escape and goals are unmet, and our subsistence needs are not being met.
Over 100 people signed up to give testimony at April's meeting of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. The council meets 5 times a year to discuss how to manage federal fisheries in Alaska. And even though they don't manage chum salmon, that's managed by the state, that seems to be what everyone wants to talk about.
Our people are salmon people. We have a deep spiritual connection with salmon that is fundamental to our way of life.
Dismal Western Alaska salmon returns have reached crisis levels. And while the council listened to scores of testimonies recalling empty rivers and vacant fish camps, the council was also presented with research that suggested bycatch limits wouldn't do much to help the crisis. The real culprit, according to scientists and fisheries managers, is warming oceans. The council said in a statement, quote, "Available science indicates recent declines in chum salmon populations across many regions of the North Pacific, including Canada, Japan, Russia, Korea, and the U.S., appear to be driven by warmer water temperatures in both the marine and freshwater environments," end quote. The importance of climate change isn't lost on those advocating for bycatch limits. But climate solutions are far away and abstract. Controlling how many salmon are scooped up by trawlers seems a simpler problem to solve. The Ocean Conservancy, a national nonprofit that signed on in support of Western Alaska tribes, said in a written testimony they acknowledge that warming oceans were driving the salmon emergency. But they say, while there are many factors contributing to the declines, bycatch is a known stressor that can be controlled and minimized. Many people testified in defense of the pollock fishery, and they point to a program that supports coastal communities. The Community Development Quota Program is a federal program that supports infrastructure projects in mainly native coastal villages. The CDQ groups are organized by region. Luke Fanning is the CEO of the group for the Aleutians and Pribilofs, the Aleutian-Pribilof Island Community Development Association. He says hard caps on the pollock fishery would hurt community members in the half dozen villages he represents.
We are very concerned about the subsistence needs of Western Alaska communities. But we also have to consider the efficacy of the solutions being proposed and find a way to navigate through this, because our communities in Western Alaska are also so very dependent on this fishery.
APICTA focuses on economic development programs for half a dozen coastal communities along the Bering Coast. And it's supported by the pollock fishery. While it's true that a large percentage of the pollock fleet is based out of state, nearly a third of the Bering Sea pollock quota is owned by the Western Alaska CDQ program.
I think it's been framed as this trade-off of sorts between pollock fishing and subsistence, but it feels almost like a false choice.
The council considered several options to manage bycatch, including a hard cap on how many chum can be caught, or regulating where the pollock fleet can fish during salmon season. The council didn't take any action to adopt any of the options, and instead revised them for further review, which is expected in late 2024 or early 2025. In Anchorage, I'm Theo Greenlee.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture recently awarded a grant to a multi-phase solar investment project in Soldotna. The project, which is now nearing completion, will generate enough energy to power 4 small businesses. KDLL's Hunter Morrison visited the project site to learn more about what the grant is being used for.
Whistle Hill, the complex of businesses just east of Soldotna, including a coffee shop, restaurant, and frame store, is now accompanied by a large assortment of solar panels. The final phase of the 2-stage project, which will be completed this summer, was just awarded a $460,000 grant from the Department of Agriculture's Rural Energy for America program, or REAP. The solar array consists of inverters, batteries, and 600 solar panels and will generate enough electricity to meet the needs of all of Whistle Hill's businesses.
Well, there's a misconception that solar doesn't work in Alaska. it's dark up here, and it's cloudy, and it rains, and it snows, and all of those things are true, but the fact is that solar does work up here.
This is Henry Kroll, the owner of Whistle Hill and Peninsula Solar, a local solar panel design and installation company.
In fact, solar works as well as many places in the lower 48. It does not work as well. It's not as efficient or capable as a solar array in Arizona or California, where they get sunshine 90% of the time. We don't get nearly that degree of sunshine up here, but when the sun does shine, particularly in the summertime, you can create a huge amount of renewable energy.
Kroll originally wanted solar panels on Whistle Hill to provide an environmentally friendly way to offset high electricity costs incurred from Fresh 365, his indoor garden that sells locally grown produce. After receiving REAP funding for phase one of the project, 224 solar panels were installed in 2022 to meet the garden's electricity needs and then some. Not long after, phase two added another 376 solar panels to the property. Kroll says the latest Department of Energy grants will pay for 50% of the projected costs associated with phase two.
It just makes it more affordable, makes it more reasonable, and the return on investment is quicker as a result. But I would have done this phase two project even again without a USDA grant, so it just helped to make it more feasible.
This project is a prime example of how the REAP grant program helps small businesses thrive in their communities by offsetting their energy costs.
This is Misty Hull, business program specialist with the Department of Agriculture.
It's a place that I frequent when I go down to the peninsula. In fact, last month, I enjoyed a French press coffee made by the power of the sun. So it was just a really great experience. And I really feel like this is a program that has really helped these businesses thrive.
Although the solar array will power all of Whistle Hill, the businesses will remain on the power grid when solar energy is not feasible. Kroll says the solar batteries can only hold a few days of energy supply at a time.
I think it's important that the community and really the whole state realizes that solar is a viable option. It's not the only option. It doesn't work 100% of the time, but it is feasible to do solar in Alaska. It's possible to save money on your electric bill.
Alaska gets more than 50% of its energy generation from natural gas. Kroll hopes local utility companies will vet for more renewable energy options in the future. In Soldotna, I'm Hunter Morrison.
This month, Anchorage residents voted down a $4 million bond that would have fulfilled a years-long goal to get two cemeteries built in two communities on opposite ends of the municipality. But as Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, supporters are not giving up just yet.
Tommy O'Malley's been working for years to get a cemetery built in Girdwood, so long that when the bond that would have funded the project failed, people reached out to him in sympathy.
The people that have called me up that know that I've been doing this a long time, they've been giving me condolences like, you know, my mom died or something.
56% of voters rejected the bond to help fund the Girdwood work and two other cemetery projects. It was one of just two bonds to fail in this year's city election. O'Malley says the land for the proposed Girdwood Cemetery is already owned by the city, and the $1.75 million in bond money would have gone to developing the essential parts of his vision.
Even without the driveway, even without the trails, you could go back with a grid and pick your grave site and bury a person or put their cremains in the ground. And the grid would keep track of where the bodies are buried.
On the other side of the municipality, up north, Tom Looney has been working to get a cemetery built in the Eagle River Chugiak area. Like Girdwood, Eagle River and Chugiak are separate towns that are part of the municipality of Anchorage. Neither area has a public cemetery, something Looney says is a symbol of any community.
You go and visit a community in the lower 48, how many of those communities don't have cemeteries?
Looney says a big reason he began thinking about establishing a cemetery was to help uphold the town's history independent of the big city.
Some of our community leaders, when they pass away, they end up shipping the body to Lower 48 or go to, you know, Palmer or whatever. We have no identity as a community of who our founders were.
Like the Girdwood Project, the Eagle River Cemetery would have received $1.75 million. Unlike that project, though, Looney says the bond money would have likely covered the full cost of the project, including a small maintenance shelter and a small roofed area for inclement weather.
Bad weather, people would be able to stand under a shelter as they were having a ceremony out there. Really no frills for the Tugak Eagle River Cemetery. It was pretty bare bones.
The remaining $500,000 in the bond would have gone towards maintenance at the Anchorage Memorial Cemetery. Cemetery Director Rob Jones says the city got a large donation of 2,000 grave markers about 20 years ago, but they were installed directly into the ground instead of into concrete like the city does now.
So out of the 2,000 markers that we got donated, 80% of them are overgrown and functionally not marking graves anymore.
He says most of the bond money he would have gotten would have gone to fixing those markers. The rest would have gone to upgrades to make the cemetery more ADA compliant and to build a new columbarium for urns. While the bond didn't directly address capacity in the Anchorage Cemetery, Jones says it's a looming issue. He anticipates the cemetery will run out of plots for the public by this summer.
For the public in that capacity question? July?
Of this year.
Yeah, we're down to like 20.
Supporters say it's unclear why voters rejected the bond, but they have some ideas. Jones says lumping the three projects together may have turned people off.
I wasn't confident that it would pass. It had such a big price tag on it.
Meanwhile, Looney says there may need to be broader outreach to highlight why new cemeteries are necessary.
I think there needs to be a little bit of inertia that has to happen before it gets on the bond. And the inertia is making sure that people understand the need.
Jones, Looney, and O'Malley say they still plan on pursuing the funding to get their projects done, whether it's through donations, grants, or trying to get another bond together. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
A wrestler from the Northwest Arctic might be heading to the Olympics this summer. KOTZ's Desiree Hagen reports.
Spencer Woods says he fell in love with wrestling when he was in second grade at Shognak School.
It was a sport that just, you know, that I gravitated towards ever since, you know, I was little.
Woods started out wrestling freestyle as a kid, but the 25-year-old now competes in Greco-Roman style. He says growing up in rural Alaska, basketball and wrestling were the only options for sports, and he chose wrestling.
Of everything I liked, the individuality of the sport, I liked that, you know, everything I do will either help me or hurt me. You know, I can't point fingers during competition because, you know, I've had all the opportunity to train for whatever happens on competition days.
Wood says growing up in Shognak, a community of around 250, and later moving to the more populated but still remote city of Kotzebue, shaped him as an athlete.
In the lower 48, you know, there's a common saying it takes a village, but in Alaska, it feels a little bit more literal. And, you know, I kind of had a disadvantage. You know, I didn't have as many competitions. I didn't have as much exposure to the sport as other athletes. But no other athlete had to grow up the way I grew up. They don't know, you know, what it's like to be out in 40 below and chase caribou, or, you know, just like everything that, that, you know, kind of makes our home our home.
After earning his bachelor's degree in biology, Woods joined the Army. He spent the last several years away from home, stationed at Fort Carson in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Woods is part of the World Class Athlete Program, which allows soldier athletes to train and compete in high-level competitions like the Olympics and Paralympics while they are enlisted. Woods says the discipline of the Army and the program helped him focus on athletics.
You know, I just made a decision a long time ago that I was going to be the best wrestler that I can be. And so I said yes to that. So I'm saying no to all these different things. Because I said yes to being a world-class athlete, you know, I'm being disciplined in my sleep. You know, I don't go out on weekends. You know, I don't eat junk food.
Wood says he has an intense training schedule, practicing at least 4 hours a day, 6 days a week. He's already competed in 2 world championships and believes he has a good chance of making the U.S. Olympic team. Woods says being able to compete at an international level has been his dream since he was in high school. He credits a lot of his success to the support he received from the region and his parents. He says although his training schedule is intense at the moment, he wants to return to the Northwest Arctic and encourage kids to keep going, even when times are tough.
You know, every time I'm back home, you know, I talk to the kids in Shungnak. You know, my story seems a little unbelievable to some, but, you know, it's if you're stubborn enough, you know, you can do it.
Woods will be at the Wrestling Olympic Trials in Maryland later this week, where he will find out for certain if he will be going to the Summer Games in Paris. In Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin, Rachel Cassandra, Chris Clint, Wesley Early, and Theo Greenlee in Anchorage, Hunter Morrison in Soldotna, and Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.